Today on Wings.
Women's issues are not just identity politics.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Here with our program is Fran Luck, host and producer of The Joy of Resistance, a weekly feminist program on community radio WBAI in New York City. The show was recorded on December 4th, 2016.
Tonight, we're going to be looking at the post-election blame game. Who messed up? Who can we hate? Who can we blame? Who let this happen? Its latest iteration is the charge that Hillary Clinton focused too much on, quote, identity politics. And we're told she alienated the white working class by talking too much about race and sex. So that is a partial quote from an article in Feminist Current by our guest, Susan Cox. And we're going to interrogate, as they say, the term identity politics. And we're also going to be playing excerpts from the huge women's meeting that took place on November 15th in response to a call by National Women's Liberation to organize the resistance.
The mountain moving day is coming. I know you don't believe it, but I know that it's true. All right. Only while the mountain sleeps, in the past all mountains moved in fire. Yet you may not believe it, this alone believe. All right.
I think we have on the line our guest, Susan Cox. Susan is a feminist writer, activist, and educator in philosophy. She's a regular contributor and a member of Feminist Current, and she's a member of the Wolf Board of Directors. That's Women's Liberation Front. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Fran.
So you, I, and many others have, of course, been poring over all of the post-election hand-wringing and the blame game, as you call it in your article. And your article is called Women's Issues Are Not Just Identity Politics. Identity politics is the phrase du jour, and we're going to be deconstructing it, looking at it, checking out its history. You start your article by saying the post-election blame game is in full swing. Who messed up? Who can we hate? Who can we blame? Who let this happen? Its latest iteration is the charge that Hillary Clinton focused too much on identity politics. We're told she alienated white working class voters by talking too much about race and sex rather than in broad economic terms alone. So define for us, for our audience that may not be familiar with the term, what exactly is identity politics, or what are they?
Well, identity politics, this term, it's mostly used as a derogatory term. It has a negative connotation to it, and it has been that way for quite a long time. But specifically right now, how people are using the term identity politics, it's used to mean this sort of political unsophistication where people who don't focus on the substantial issues are too lazy to do that. They just will mobilize politically along lines of their personal identity. Like if you're a woman, voting for Hillary Clinton is said to be identity politics, or this sort of baiting of voters. Clinton was accused of using identity politics to bait Latino voters by talking about her plan for immigration reform. So it's a sort of shallow appeal to identity, and that is the scapegoat today in saying, how could this have happened, you know, because yeah. We're all just so reeling from yeah. Trump being elected. Of course, a very easy scapegoat to turn to is women, women's fault.
That woman candidate who was, as you say in your article, sort of an example of identity politics no matter what she did, whether she mentioned it or not, right?
Because she's just a diversity candidate. White men like to say, oh, she just got the job because she's a woman, yeah. Minimizing the issues.
All right. So can you tell us where this term came from? Because it hasn't been around forever, and it's very hot right now. If you Google it, you'll find, you know, a zillion articles.
Well, it came around in the 70s, but it didn't really become prominent in academia until the 80s. And during that time in academia, it was during the Cold War and when Marxist political analysis was being discouraged. So it rose to prominence as a way to replace the concept of class politics. And class politics was replaced with the idea that political mobilization, for example, the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, wasn't based on class revolts, but on individuals sharing some common identity. So in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of feminist theorists who were writing about identity politics and claiming that feminism was nothing more than identity politics, and that women were mobilized not based on shared class interests, but on having some common identity or shared experience of being women. And this turned out to be very harmful to the feminist movement and was the beginning of the foundation of the third wave of feminism. And the third wave of feminism focuses very much on identity and very much on the personal. And so this sort of need for class consciousness, class politics, was replaced with a very personal brand of lifestyle feminism, where all the focus is placed on the individual and the individual's actions rather than a wider political movement.
Right. And which turns on its head the famous maxim that was started by Carol Hanisch, the personal is political, by which she meant that when you examine personal facts of your life, you'll find out they have political causes. But it's sort of been turned on its head so that now anything you do, you know, the shoes you buy or whatever, is your politics.
And it's certainly an inversion of what Carol Hanisch originally said. Mostly identity politics, the term, has been used to kind of deride feminist work and anti-racist work as less politically substantial. You know, we see with Bernie Sanders today talking about how, the left failed because they weren't focusing on the big issues, the economic issues, and instead we're focusing on these divisive issues of racism and sexism. We need to stop talking in those terms. So it's mostly been used derogatorily, but there is kind of a useful way of using the term identity politics, and actually that is descriptive of current politics, when all that the politics are is identity, when what they are advocating to do is these personal performances. And we see this with the turn in feminist theory around this time in the 80s and 90s with Judith Butler and Judith Butler's theory of performativity. And she argued that we can have feminist progress through these individual performances of identity, that we can have these performances that will be subversive and cause some sort of feminist progress.
Such as
a man wearing lipstick, uh-huh. Or a woman wearing a suit, or walking in a certain way. So all these like very individual actions. So I would say identity politics is descriptive when we're talking about that, because that's literally what the politics
what it is.
Are.
Yeah, right.
And we see that in feminism today, certainly. Some identity politics when feminism is construed as totally personal, such as like, I don't wear makeup, I don't sleep with any men, I don't wear these certain clothes. I am a feminist, and this is my feminism.
Yeah, my feminism mm-hmm. is my style. Well, you were saying before about how the term identity politics is used to trivialize feminism reminds me of precursors, I think, to that, coming from the left, going way back when, in the very early days of communism, this is even before the Russian Revolution, there were huge debates about whether communists should advocate for women voting in the United States, for instance, or whether the feminist movement in the United States was simply bourgeois. And feminism was seen as a sort of bourgeois aberration from class politics. And everybody knew that once the class contradiction was resolved, sexism, they didn't call it that then, but the woman question would sort of automatically kind of sort itself out, which, of course, when feminism, the radical phase of feminism came around in the 60s, they much debated that, and they said, actually, Marx didn't take into account the means of reproduction, but only the means of production. In other words, unwaged labor was not taken into account, only wage labor. So radical feminists such as Shulamith Firestone updated Karl Marx and added that dimension. And I really think that that battle is still being played out in certain forms, and identity politics, as a pejorative word, is kind of its latest version.
It is. And this is kind of the tragedy of the whole current identity politics discussion, that it lumps all issues of sexism and racism into the category of identity politics as not being systemic political issues, but nothing more than an issue of personal identity. And this has certainly been, as you say, going on for a long time, especially with men on the left saying that women's issues are not important and more trivial, and that we need to just be focusing on purely economic issues that do not consider women or sex, because right. It's kind of like secondary, not as important.
But as you point out in the title of your essay, women's issues are not just identity politics. So that leads to the question of, if they're not identity politics, what are they? How do we characterize what women's issues are in the context of class politics?
Well, first of all, women's issues are not just identity politics, because being female is not an identity.
Uh-huh.
It is a material reality. And in fact, it's one of the most foundational material realities that is informing the organization of our world, the political organization, the social organization. And, you know, the charge that we just need to be focusing on purely economic issues and just thinking in purely economic terms leaves out the entire fact that the economic system is based on women's labor, based on women's reproduction. Women's domestic labor is what's propping up the entire economic system. And, of course, we see this from feminists who kind of expanded Marx, like Silvia Federici, who illustrated how this is kind of a blind spot in Marx, but it's really true. Even if we are just talking about economic systems, we need to talk about sex. We need to talk about women's issues. We need to talk about all of these things.
Okay, so let's round that out even more, because you're talking about structural oppression. You're talking about the structure of society and how women's issues are not sort of like a icing on the cake or something superficial, some top layer that takes away attention from the real important stuff, but are the important stuff, the important class stuff themselves. So let's see if we can give some more detail on that.
As you were saying before, women basically reproduce the mundane conditions for everyday life in their domestic labor, and that is the necessary condition to have capitalist production. It's not just white men who are affected by economics. They have a wife at home who's taking care of their children, and that's one of the ways that they're even able to go to work and be exploited by these various companies. So that needs to be a part of the conversation. It's not just something that is detracting from the conversation, as Bernie Sanders is intimating. And, you know, also, it's quite insulting that women's issues are seen as just shallow appeals to identity. We don't have headlines like, Bernie Sanders appeals to Walmart worker identity with his speech denouncing the corporation's corruption.
Yeah.
But then Clinton is said to be appealing to only identity politics when she's talking to Latina women and their issues, or just being a woman. So certain things are framed as identity when others are not, to the point where just making any reference to the social structure of reality is said to be identity politics.
Let me let our listeners know that we're speaking with Susan Cox, who wrote an article for Feminist Current called Women's Issues Are Not Just Identity Politics. And that's coming out of the debate that's going on about, like, who lost the election for the Democrats. And identity politics seems to be one of the main scapegoats, that phrase. And we're looking at that phrase, and we're looking at its reality and its unreality. So, Susan, what haven't we identified in this discussion yet?
Just that it's very important to speak about the problem of sexism in terms of it being a material structural system of power,
mm-hmm.
and not just merely an issue of identity, because that's what it gets reduced to
right.
all the time. And I've had a lot of young women ask me, like, oh, can I be a feminist and still do this? Or can I be a feminist and do this? But feminism is not an identity. It's a political movement,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's making organized political resistance that challenges these structures of power. And what makes a feminist, is if they are doing that.
Exactly.
They are challenging these powers.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more. The Red Stockings, one of the early radical feminist women's liberation groups, had a line called the pro-woman line, which was kind of critical of feminists at that time who were critical of women who dressed kind of in a way that was considered crass or too male-pleasing, Dolly Parton, what have you. And their line was, you know, it's not really about what that woman is wearing. That woman is doing the best she can in her situation, in what her social surround is demanding of her. And what we have to do is analyze what that social surround is and not the woman herself. And it took the whole onus off that personal style thing, and it put it back on, you know, how do we understand the forces that are shaping us and on that build our movement. What you're saying is a kind of modern iteration of that idea.
And instead of blaming the woman and saying, like, oh, how can she make these dumb choices, instead
yeah.
focusing outward on the systems and how we can target them and destroy them, basically.
Exactly. I am kind of worried about where this is going to lead with the whole identity politics, because it's kind of a way of saying to women, shut up, you just ruined it for everybody. And it's also saying that to Black people and Latinos and et cetera. Only the white men, apparently, and the white women who went along with them didn't ruin it for everybody. You know?
Yeah, it's being cast as like this sort of selfishness
yeah.
and this self-obsession of women just not being able to see the big picture.
Exactly. So we should just go back to that old leftist thinking, which I think many people have said Bernie Sanders did personify, of like, you know, class politics is the center. And, you know, and it is. But class politics is not just white working class male politics. It has all kinds of important parts that have to do with what sex you are and what race you are.
And, you know, this is kind of a tragedy of how Marx is taken up today. Class politics is seen as only economic class politics. And the whole concept of class politics in Marxism, it's really just this material exploitation that is going on. And so these feminists adopted it to take a closer look at the system of material exploitation, extracting labor and resources from women, how that whole system works. And so it's really applicable in that sense.
So how do we get it back to how it should be understood? What do you think?
Well, I think to really emphasize, to sort of wrench feminism away from this very personal individualist lifestyle view of it, and to emphasize it as being a global political movement that is about organized political resistance. And just to emphasize that as what feminism is in all of our rhetoric, and also in any politics on the left, to acknowledge the role of sexism and racism in these economic systems of exploitation, that is certainly very important to have any descriptive and accurate political analysis of the world and America.
And what holds up the class system, the work of women, the extraction of resources from Black people and other oppressed people, that is holding up the class system. So it's an integral part of the class system. Susan Cox, it has been absolutely great having you on the air on Joy of Resistance. I enjoyed your article very much. I hope people will go and read the whole thing at feministcurrent.com. And the name of the article is Women's Issues Are Not Just Identity Politics. And you go into a lot more in that article. Thank you so very much for being on Joy of Resistance.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
In the past, all mountains moved in fire.
All sleeping women now awake.
All sleeping women and now awake and move.
All sleeping women now awake. All sleeping women.
We are now going to go to excerpts from an incredible speak out that took place on November 15th. It was actually a meeting that had so many women in attendance that it spilled out into the street where a spontaneous speak out took place. And tonight we're going to hear a little bit of what went on inside at the regular meeting. The group was National Women's Liberation, and you can reach them at womensliberation.org. Let's go to Jenny Brown, giving her analysis of the feminist movement, its rights and its wrongs in relation to this past election.
So my name is Jenny Brown, and I have been involved in women's liberation since 1986. I've been to several forums, like I'm sure many of you have, analyzing the election results, who voted, who didn't, the fact that among white women who voted, 53% voted for Trump. I do want to address the 53% because of how it relates to the history of our movement and our group in particular. And it also contains a self-criticism and relates to what we do want to do here tonight. We trace our group's origins to 50 years ago when Black leaders in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the radical vanguard of the civil rights movement, told the whites in the organization to leave, to go out into the white community and to fight your own oppressors. Among those whites sent out of SNCC on this mission were women radicals, committed workers who had been jailed and risked their lives in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. They carried out their Black co-workers' instructions by tackling male supremacy, and in 1967 started the Women's Liberation Movement. Some of those women are founding members of our group. Black women's liberation effort also originated in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. At the time, women didn't think they were oppressed as women. No woman thought this, or if she suspected it, she thought she had to deal with it individually. But using lessons they learned from the civil rights movement and Black power, women's liberation transformed a whole lot of ordinary, non-political, non-avant-garde, largely white women who didn't think they were oppressed into a powerful radical force that in many ways revolutionized life in the United States by the early 70s. This should give us hope. So-called apolitical women can be quite radical if we dare to organize them. The combination of Black liberation, feminist, student, anti-war, Latino, Latina, Native American, veteran, gay liberation, and labor organizing put the power structure back on its heels for some time. All those movements pushing simultaneously meant progress for all of us. And if you want more of this history, please go to the Red Stockings Women's Liberation Archives. Here's the self-criticism, though. Speaking for myself and other feminists, we clearly have not done our assignment from SNCC sufficiently. We made some giant advances early on, but most women haven't seen a strong, visible women's liberation movement. One that bases its demands on the lives and experiences of women and takes aim at both male supremacy and the 1%. Therefore, the vast majority of women, like the majority of people in the U.S., didn't vote at all. They didn't see their interests reflected in this election. They were demobilized and alienated, and women's liberation didn't provide another vision. So we need to do that. Defending ourselves and others against immediate attacks is necessary, and we make it a priority. But one lesson is that it's not enough. Feminists need to be better at our assigned movement job, in some ways harder, which is to organize unorganized women, and that includes white women. This is one response to the criticism that if you are organizing white women, you are not doing the real work. We think this election indicates that that is incorrect. To be clear, as SNCC certainly understood, this is how we effectively organize against racism, too. It's a two-step process. For white women to see how racism and all our other biases and blind spots are against our interests as women, we first have to see that we have interests as women. Otherwise, fake identities such as whiteness can become primary. But as a women's liberation movement, we cannot exclusively focus on white women, of course. We will not win. We think the strongest way is to organize as women, meaning women of color and white women together, with a caucus of women of color, because the movement requires some focused study by women of color, with women of color leading and white women following their leadership on issues of race and racism in the movement. Our aim is to both organize whites, as directed by Black SNCC leaders, by organizing white women, and to organize women of color. How did the women's liberation movement organize? They adapted the testifying and the tell it like it is that they saw in the civil rights movement, and they invented consciousness raising. This happened among women who didn't think they were ever oppressed as women, and it spread like wildfire. In consciousness raising, women compared experiences and learned that what we thought were personal issues actually share a political root. They analyzed how they were oppressed and who was benefiting and who was to blame. Some said it was scarier, at least at first, to confront the realities of their own lives than it had been to face down Southern sheriffs. This is why they said, people don't get radicalized fighting other people's battles. When we do consciousness raising, we talk from our own experience, we talk about our own stake, we take off the rose-colored glasses, we speak for ourselves. When we understand our own stake in change, we can combine on a solid basis of understanding across the many things that divide us and identify common interests, common enemies, and common goals.
All sleeping women now awake and
all sleeping
move.
Women now awake
all
and
sleeping
move.
Women and now awake and move. All sleeping women now awake, all sleeping women and now awake, all sleeping women and now awake and move.
You've been listening to excerpts from Women's Issues Are Not Just Identity Politics with producer and host Fran Luck of The Joy of Resistance, a weekly feminist community radio program on WBAI, New York. The music was from Mountain Moving Day by the Chicago Women's Liberation Rock Band, recorded in 1972. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our Facebook page, facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including CJSF-FM Burnaby, B.C., your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wing sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.